Sudan has had sort of the longest fight, I would say, for democracy, probably in the region, the longest sustained fight for democracy. And that's where the investments that have to be made, in a political settlement that prefaces civilian and democratic groups and puts about a framework for a lasting constitution, for the transition that can actually hold, and to actually bring about sort of incentive structures rooted in accountability for all the actors that are involved. Peace or some kind of ceasefire without accountability doesn't work.
Pan-roasted politics, no sugar. International politics, just as you like. To the point. Without filter and no extras. And hopefully, well-tempered. And now, please welcome your host for today.
Hello, everyone. Welcome again to a new episode of FES podcast. And we are glad today to have Ms. Khulood Khair, a political analyst and the founder of Confluence Advisory Think Tank, founded in Khartoum. Khulood, welcome. And we are glad to have you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Khulood, looking at the context of the war in Sudan, the war between SAF and RSF, it marked by extreme brutalities, even against a civilian. Why do you think there is no red lines for the two parties of the war?
I think the reality is that in many of Sudan's wars, there has never been a red line against civilians. It's just that those civilians have tended to come from what we often call the peripheral parts of the country. Now the violence is all over the country, and particularly in Khartoum, Jazeera, places that had been protected against that kind of state violence and that kind of warfare by, you know, different governments throughout Sudan's history, independence history. But just to note that, you know, this war started off very much as a war between, you know, the Sudanese Armed Forces, the SAF, and the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF. But it has then become some, you know, dynamic between them has produced a centrifugal force that is pulling in other armed actors, other different groups, including civilian groups, and even parts of sort of civil society or civic life, including different tribal groups, etc. And so this is becoming far more characterized by a war that's not just between two groups. And what this means is, some analysts say, you know, we're having four wars in one, which means the characteristics of the war in Darfur, for example, look very different to the characteristics of war in places like Jazeera. And what this means is that, you know, effectively, wherever civilians are, they still find themselves at the sort of mercy of the different groups that are fighting, whether it's the SAF and the RSF or the RSF and other groups. And so to me, this is very much a war against civilians. Yes, it's the war with, you know, between different elements of the security state and now different actors outside of the security state. But predominantly, this is a war against Sudan civilians. And it makes sense because this war follows a large revolution where unequivocally the people of Sudan rejected military rule. And so for the RSF and SAF and the other armed groups that are involved in this, regardless of, you know, who gets more, becomes more dominant or who strives more for a military victory, whoever takes over or whatever the post-war dispensation looks like, they will have to deal with a population that does not want to see military rule. And so a large objective of this war is to minimize the extent of the anti-militarism or the pro-democracy movement that would then stand against a potential victor.
Okay, going on from this point, stating that this war mainly is against civilian population. All the ongoing dispute settlement initiatives right now seems to be led by the international community, whether from United States, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, whatever. Why do you think there is no a national dialogue or a Sudanese viable dialogue and initiatives to end the war in Sudan right now?
There have been some attempts to try to do this. But one of the key characteristics of this war is that it has, you know, worked very hard and has been very successful, actually, at polarizing the political discourse. And that means that you find people that, you know, are pulled in a direction where they believe they have to back either the SAF or the RSF. And that can be related to, for example, where they live, what ethnic background they have, how they perceive the chances that they have in life with either one group or the other, the history they might have with one group or the other, the level of violence and the level of safety that they perceive from one group or the other. So it's a variety of different things. But in the end, the fact that a lot of people are becoming partisan increasingly actually risks, I think, the extent to which you can bring these people together towards some kind of united front. And what the different sides are doing, particularly the SAF and the RSF, is creating the foundations for the war to continue every day. You know, they're effectively manufacturing consent for a longer term warfare. And they're doing this by saying, you know, it's us or them. They're doing this by saying these people will not let you live in the way that you know. They're saying this by it's always sort of an attack on the other. Now, of course, when we look at what's happening in Sudan, some of these claims are actually very true. You know, if you speak to people in Darfur, it's very difficult for them to see, for example, a life with the RSF. And similarly, in different parts of the country, including, for example, Gezira, especially after all the atrocities that have been committed. But if we are to have a political resolution to this war, and I believe you can only have a political resolution to this war, you cannot have a military victory. Sudan is way too big. It is very difficult to have a full military victory for any of the sides here, even if they have strong alliances within the country, even if they have a lot of backing from outside of the country. And in order to get to that political agreement, we need to have people come together on a minimum agenda. I think most people in Sudan, regardless of who they support, recognize that this war is not a good thing. People have lost their jobs, their livelihoods, their homes, friends and family. They know that war is bad. But there is this juggernaut of a PR campaign, a public relations campaign from both sides. And it's really aimed at creating the foundations and the justifications for this war to continue.
Yeah, mentioning that there is an external backing for the two parties of war, as you mentioned. Many observers right now pointing toward United Arab Emirates for supporting the RSF. And that means it's responsible of the continuation of the war in Sudan. Doesn't you think that this is too easy, or what is your read for this?
I think it's true, but it's not the full story. I think that, you know, same with the story of, you know, this is a war between two generals. It's not incorrect. It's just incomplete. That is not the whole story. Similarly with the UAE, I think now we have almost irrefutable evidence that the United Arab Emirates is indeed supporting the RSF. The Wall Street Journal, CNN, the New York Times, the United Nations' own panel of experts report on Darfur has said that there is credible evidence that the United Arab Emirates is supporting the RSF in terms of weaponry and materiel. So I think, you know, there's no point in wasting time really asking the question, is the UAE supporting the RSF or not? I think we can take that, you know, as a sort of a fact. The question is, who else is in the fray? And we know that Egypt is in the fray. We know that Saudi Arabia is in the fray. We know that Iran is in the fray. We know that Turkey is in the fray. And I think looking at it only from a UAE supporting RSF lens actually sort of obfuscates the other actors that are at play. And if we're trying to figure out a resolution for this, that doesn't help us. So we have to look at, what does Egypt want out of Sudan? What does Saudi Arabia want out of Sudan? How do they plan on engineering a political outcome for this war that suits their interests? And do those interests align with ours, or do they not? And right now, it's very difficult to get a lot of people to think beyond the United Arab Emirates and its impact on Sudan, and trying to look for a more comprehensive view of what is going on. That doesn't mean letting the UAE off the hook. I think there's been tremendous pressure on the UAE, mostly from Sudanese activists, mostly from Sudanese civil society, that is now permeating into diplomatic circles. And that's great, because without the support that the UAE is giving to the RSF would not be able to wage its campaign on terror on the people of Sudan. But we must look at the other side as well, because that helps us to understand actually where the opportunities are to bring about a resolution to this war.
طيب, Ms. Khulod, moving on from the war narrative to the UN intervention. It seems right now the UN is unable to put an end to the war in Sudan. And also when people, there is no even any discussion around peacekeeping in Sudan. And whenever this discussion is open, people just directly close it. Why do you think the UN are not able or not proactive in protecting the civilian in Sudan?
I think the United Nations is not interested, frankly, in taking a lead role in Sudan. We have seen this very, very clearly. The UN doesn't have, within the United Nations Security Council, it doesn't have the kind of support it has, for example, to put in a special representative. So there's a personal envoy of the Secretary General instead. This means that he is not beholden to the Security Council. It means that the members of the Security Council are not as invested, as it were, in what he's trying to achieve. But really, I think what we're dealing with here is that there's been a decline in the role of the United Nations across the board. I mean, even if we look at countries where the UN is trying to be more actively involved, for example, in Gaza, there's very little that the UN is able to do there. But it's also very clear that the UN is, you know, very unwilling to engage and has effectively outsourced the Sudan file to the region, to the African Union and to IGAD. And this follows the principle of subsidiarity, which is very important in international relations. But it doesn't mean that the UN just gets to take a backseat. And one of the ways that we saw the UN absolutely taking a backseat is on the protection of civilians mandate. Now, ordinarily, it is the government of any given country that has the constitutional mandate to protect its civilians without external intervention. But we have two things in Sudan right now. We don't have a constitutional basis because of the coup, and the very people that, you know, led the coup in 2021 are now the people at war. So we can't expect either of these people to uphold the constitutional, you know, rule or constitutional duty that without a constitution. The second thing is that protection of civilians has become something of a partisan issue, and it shouldn't be. It's absolutely a humanitarian issue. It's about protecting civilians. It's not about getting involved in the sort of intricate politics between the two groups. And if we think about, you know, the RSF was quite literally created to wage wars of terror against civilians. So there's absolutely no expectation that they would be in a position to provide protection to civilians. And whilst the Sudanese Armed Forces, historically, as a military, has only ever fought its own people, with very few exceptions. So there again, and many populations in Sudan and what is now South Sudan can attest to the Sudanese Armed Forces' inability and unwillingness to protect civilians. And in fact, its targeting of civilians over the decades. So there, what we have here in Sudan is a protection vacuum. And so there is a need for the international community to get involved in figuring out what kind of protection modality works best for the people of Sudan. And we haven't seen that. Now, very recently, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, which is a regional bloc, has said that it's thinking about putting forth some kind of protection of civilians force or mission in country. Of course, the United Nations' own fact-finding mission also recommended an impartial and independent force to be brought into Sudan. But as we saw, both on the 28th of October with the Secretary General's recommendations on the protection of civilians, which were very, very poor. And then just very recently, Russia's veto of a resolution that actually didn't call for the protection of civilians. It was much more about upholding the Jeddah agreement of last year. But we saw an allergy to the wording around the protection of civilians and really mandating international actors to undertake the protection of civilians. Now, that Russian veto was very much informed by what's happening in Ukraine. It's not actually something to do with Sudan. And to my understanding, Russia was going to abstain from the vote. It wasn't going to veto entirely. The veto came because Ukraine had used American missiles on the Russian army and the Russian allies. And therefore, Russia retaliated by blocking what it saw as an American and British-led resolution during Britain's presidency at the Security Council. What this means is we must look beyond these institutions that are obviously stymied by their own rules to be able to look at how we can think about the protection of civilians. There are so many ways of doing, you know, protection of civilians. There is, for example, early warning systems. There's community-based protection mechanisms. There are restoring infrastructure, for example, the telecoms that have been missing since, you know, at least February. And those are the things that we can look at that would absolutely, you know, ameliorate and improve the situation for civilians until such time the political space is there for the protection of civilians through perhaps a protection of civilians mission. Now, just to go back to this idea that the UN is actually, you know, washing its hands of protecting civilians in Sudan, you know, we're seeing the wording from the Secretary General very much say, rather than saying, let's try and move beyond the political impediments and figure out how we can protect Sudanese civilians who are stuck in a war that has produced the world's largest protection crisis. What we're seeing the Secretary General do is say, the conditions currently don't exist for protection of civilians force, and so effectively we're going to abandon striving for the protection of Sudanese people. So that is a really unfortunate development. I think what's even more unfortunate is that there are people in Sudan, particularly those who support the Sudanese armed forces, that see the protection of civilians as some kind of foreign intervention that is inimical or against their interests. But actually, because most of the atrocities are being carried out by the RSF, it is actually in the interest of people who support SAF to back a protection of civilians mission. So this is what I was saying about it now becoming partisan and effectively a political football. And therefore, we need to move away from the partisan element as well. So beyond institutions, beyond partisan politics, and really to focus on what it means to actually do effective protection of civilians given the current circumstances, and look forward to a time where we can do much, much more, more ambitiously.
We at FES and also our audience, we are interested in listening to your opinion on the way out of all of this. What do you think, and how is the way out of this in the middle of all this global disorder?
It's very difficult to figure out how to untangle something that every day is becoming more convoluted and every day is becoming more entrenched. And, you know, there are people who simply say to you, if you want to resolve this issue, you have to go to Riyadh, you have to go to Abu Dhabi, you have to go to Cairo, you have to strike a deal between those powers, and then everything will be fine. Or at least you can find something that works in the interests of those countries, and then that would lessen, you know, the propensity for war in Sudan. And then there are those who say to you, it's a Sudanese problem and the Sudanese only can fix it. And I think actually both of those things. It's exactly the interplay between local interests, domestic interests of the different fighting groups and those who support them, as well as the interests of those abroad, particularly in the Gulf and particularly in Egypt. And finding the right sort of mixture of agreements between those groups is where I think the answer lies. Now, getting there is going to be very difficult. As you said earlier, there are so many different mediation platforms. There is so much political competition between different mediators and different political and diplomatic actors. There's so much political competition and polarization within the country, within Sudan. But that all becomes difficult. The risk here is, this war is going towards what we're seeing, an increased fragmentation within the troops, within the groups that are fighting, within the territory of Sudan. You know, more and more we're seeing signs that a split may happen across the country, which would be awful for everyone and absolutely not in the interests of peace. We're also seeing that, you know, there's increased ethnicization, and that really lays the groundwork for genocide and other mass atrocities. And we're seeing the fact that, you know, the longer this war continues, the more it becomes, frankly, taken out of the hands of people in Sudan and placed much more in, you know, capitals in the region where Sudanese people have very little authority and power to influence. And the last thing that we need is to be, you know, a sort of a proxy or vassal state for either a Gulf country or a neighboring country. You know, Sudan has had a very rich history. Not all of it has been positive, but there has been a very strong thread of revolutionary power, of pro-democracy activism. You know, Sudan has had sort of the longest fight, I would say, for democracy, probably in the region, the longest sustained fight for democracy. And that's where the investments have to be made, in a political settlement that prefaces civilian and democratic groups and puts about a framework for a lasting constitution, for the transition that can actually hold, and to actually bring about sort of incentive structures rooted in accountability for all the actors that are involved. Peace or some kind of ceasefire without accountability doesn't work. And to get to a ceasefire, we need a political agreement. If you don't have a political agreement that is representative of the ideas of the people of Sudan, as well as representative of the people of Sudan themselves, we're not going to get anywhere very fast. The unfortunate thing is, I don't see that happening anytime soon, as far as the diplomatic community is concerned, and as far as the efforts in the diplomatic community are, but where I see the hope absolutely is in the work that Sudanese people are still doing in civil society, in mutual aid, in the emergency rooms, and the work that is frankly continuing to keep Sudan as an entity, as a whole, as something that people want to sort of fight for, rather than something that is ripping people apart and then is also drawing the region into potentially a forever war.
Hand-Roasted Politics, No Sugar, is a Studio Fritz production for the German Friedrich Ebert Stiftung.